The place was bustling, many searching for herbs. I grew impatient with the wait, visiting so often. I knew where everything was, so I'd pull out 5 or 6 drawers, arranging them on the counter. In the end, I didn't wait for anyone's help. I'd mix the remedies myself and carry them home. Honestly, my measurements were often more precise. For any grave illness, I couldn't imagine finding healing with such uncertain remedies. Back then, my father was a devout believer in a renowned healer in Codateno. He visited daily, and I often found myself tagging along. Afterwards, it was just me, my hand held gently by my wet nurse, making the pilgrimage to the shrine. I didn't really know how to pray. I just pressed my hands together, wishing for my mother's recovery, half in playful thought. June the 15th was my birthday. That day, after a ritual shave and a warm bath, they dressed me in a long-sleeved formal kimono. It sounds a little odd to say I was wearing it. It was a 5-crested kimono with a vibrant hem pattern, a flashy no-shime design. Now I hear it's called kagazome. Chrysanthemums, bush clover, cherry blossoms. A bouquet of flowers formed the crests. Without regard for the seasons, a medley of various blossoms was dyed into the fabric. Of course, no one wears such a crested kimono anymore, especially not in other provinces. It's said that only Kaga artisans dye these patterns. They celebrate Montyu's beauty, where all 4 seasons' flowers bloom as one. Well, I wore that formal kimono, cinched with a child's Hakata obi. It was scarlet with a single doko design. The little boy was all neat and tidy, dressed so beautifully. Mother tied up her loose hair, purified her hands. As the wet nurse draped the formal kimono from behind, Mother slipped her arms through the sleeves. Then she wrapped a light blue undersash around her chest. But when she reached for her obi to tie it herself, her strength simply drained away, her knees giving out. The wet nurse quickly caught her, holding her close. Then Mother immediately pressed her solar plexus onto a velvet pillow, collapsing her chest upon it. Father had told me that to thank her for my birth, I only needed to say, "Be well." So I knelt by her pillow, my hands braced on the floor. My face, looking up, met my mother's gaze. She had been watching me intently, leaning on her pillow. "My boy," she said, "I am returning now." Tears fell softly, and she looked down, fragile and weak. Father held her shoulder, gently laying her down onto her side. When the wet nurse draped the padded quilt over her, she reached for her own collar and quietly turned away. From the kitchen, from the inner rooms, and near the entrance, hurried sounds of people moving echoed. Indeed, when she collapsed, dressed in her dark blue crested kimono and undersash, attempting to tie her obi, the wet nurse had cried out for help. Soon enough, the doctor came rushing in, his hakama hems dragging softly behind him. The wet nurse told me to go outside and play, so I quietly slipped out through the garden. Even now, I can't forget that moment. I felt an unspeakably sad and lonely feeling, a profound helplessness. The flower seller, her voice a soft murmur, replied, "Yes, that makes perfect sense." "And did your mother recover after that?" she gently asked. "Listen closely, for this is what happened next. The child, surely, must have wanted to cling to the Buddha's sleeve in despair. Codateno, you see, is just a distant suburb. It's a high plateau, almost a small mountain. Many overgrown vacant lots, few passers-by. That's where I went, to the Yakushi-do hall. I had my head shaved and bathed that morning, leaving home sometime after noon. But I can't recall when I visited the Yakushi-do, where I walked, or how I fell asleep. The next morning, from Codateno, I found myself descending a pitch-dark slope named Yasaka. It was like an 8-tiered black waterfall, and somehow I ended up by the riverbank. The river, at the entrance to a village called Suzumi, flowed swiftly. The rapids looked truly formidable. The long bridge, bleached white by rain and snow, sagged in places like fallen scales. It lazily spanned the river. I stood there, lost in thought, upon that ancient bridge. Only later did I realize it was the next morning. But then, I had no memory of where I'd spent the night. So as a child, I simply thought it was evening, because a pure white moon had appeared above the peak of Mont Yu. But in truth, it was a waning moon, still lingering. Why? Around noon that very day, I crossed the strange upstream ferry. I was clutching a rope, suspended in midair. The sun beat down fiercely, scorching my face. When I tell it this way, it sounds like a dream, blurring dawn and dusk. But I assure you, I truly did cross that ferry. I knew the mountain path would take a full day, so I planned to stay overnight at the foot of the mountain this time. And yesterday, at the exact same hour as that day before, around noon, as I crossed that ferry, bathed in the blinding white sunlight reflecting off rocks and water. Unchanged in 20 years, the landing rocks and the pine tree where boats departed were still vividly in my memory. But when I crossed it at 9 years old, there was an old boatman steering the boat with practiced hands. Yesterday, I simply pulled myself across the rope, all alone. There were no other passengers, nothing but the river. As you know, the current is fierce, with no place for a pole to stand. So there are two ropes, with handholds so tightly woven like a stretched fabric. The boat is small. I stood upright in the middle, suspended, passing my hands from one hold to the next. For half an hour, across a river 30 ken wide, I gasped repeatedly, closing my eyes against the danger. When I opened my eyes, tall rapeseed flowers were scattered across the cliff edge. If they hadn't appeared, I don't think I would have believed I was still in this world. For 10 square ri, there seemed to be no one. On the trunk of the great pine where the boat was moored, a weathered sign read, "Ferry fee, 3 mon, 3 won't. My story has jumped ahead, out of order. The child stood on Suzumi Bridge looking ahead, into the open sky like a Buddha's outstretched palm with 5 fingers, rose Tomuro Ishiyama. Mist or fog veiled the distant peaks. Only on a few clear days each year would the blue outline of Mount Iyo reveal itself. The child had heard of this mountain before, and even in their young heart, knew its direction. Lost or perhaps enchanted by a spell, who could say? Yet, the innocent one remained strangely carefree. Maybe their mind was already elsewhere, but without hunger, no trouble could touch them. Clinging to the broken bamboo railing, they watched Mount Iyo amongst the moonlit clouds. Then, a gentle tapping sound of footsteps echoed on the bridge planks. On the mountain opposite, 3 monkeys made their home. The smallest monkey, quite the talker, began to sing, "Oh children, won't you go pick flowers on such a cold day?" What flowers would we pick? Peonies, crimson peonia, chrysanthemums, 1 for my hat, 2 for my straw cape. As branch after branch was gathered, the sun began to set. He sang. A soft thought bloomed in their heart. Ah, if I could gather those crimson flowers from the distant mountain, even in the moonlight, and place them in my mother's hair, her illness would surely fade away. And mother was still young enough to wear such flowers as a hairpin, you know. Kosaka glanced back the way they came. Only grass stretched out behind them. A flower vendor, a step ahead, walked on, head bowed, as if listening intently. And truly, They believed it was an oracle from the healing Buddha. Once the idea took hold, there was no holding back. They turned from the bridge they were crossing and followed the embankment upstream. It was a path where a ferry crossing would be needed later. From the bridge, the mountain seemed to lean towards the setting moon. From here, it looked like it floated above the clouds at the unreachable opposite bank. So turning back, in a child's heart, felt like a fortunate path. The rocks of Iwabuchi, along the way from the bridge to the ferry, could be called the first fortress of Mount Iyo, separating people. The base of Tomuro Ishiyama pressed directly against the stream, a tangle of piled rocks where the path simply ended. With Iwabuchi on one side, they were likely barefoot. Walking briskly, as if covering 5 or 10 ri, they reached Naruko Ferry around noon. They met 2 or 3 people, horsemen, porters, farmers, each time they passed a village and emerged onto the river embankment. But everyone just stopped, staring, watching them pass. No one spoke a word to them. It was an unusual attire for the countryside, a crested, long-sleeved kimono. Perhaps they thought it was a strange young lord, too dignified to approach, or a fox disguised in broad daylight. Who could say? Or perhaps the child was too overwhelmed to even hear what was said. Suddenly, just before the ferry crossing, an old man called out from behind, "Brother, brother!" A deep voice boomed. I looked up. He was sturdily built, tall and stout, with a copper-toned, rugged frame. Likely in his mid-40s, his old unlined kimono was hiked up, revealing red shins in gaiters, bare feet in straw sandals. Despite the blinding sun, he wore no straw hat. Instead, his oiled paper raincoat, folded small and long, was tied to his sedge hat string and then slung over his shoulder. 2 large tobacco pouches hung from his waist. For some reason, he fanned his chest hair with a dark paper fan, sauntering closer. "Where are you headed?" "To the mountain, to pick flowers," I replied. "Hmm. If that's the case, then I'll go with you, lad. But we must cross that ferry ahead. The ferryman might make trouble." "Come on, climb on my back." He turned his back. Stepping over his raincoat, I positioned my feet. Like a monkey's child, I was hoisted high onto his shoulders. My heart still raced with anticipation. Looking at the mountains, Tomuro seemed to recede into the distance. Mount Iyo, a vivid deep green, felt like it was seen from above my shoulders. The position had shifted. It now appeared on the opposite side of the river. "Yes, we would definitely have to cross that ferry." He placed one hand on my foot, his tobacco pouches jingling at his waist. "Grandpa, please. I'm a boy asked to see the Guardian Shrine's festival," he said. The old man who pulled the boat closer was a tiny figure. His waist was even more feeble than the ferryman's pouches, dried up like a persimmon. Soon, holding the rope, he clung on, and how swiftly we moved, like sparrows crossing a clapper, or monkeys traversing the treetops, swift and smooth. Kosaka involuntarily stamped his foot. The thick grass swayed gently around them. Flower petals drifted down once more, 2, 3 from the empty sky. As the boat swayed side to side, the blue current coiled around the hull. It turned pure white with a swift rush. The old man, accustomed to this, stood firm like a guardian deity, still carrying the child. Into the deep blue water, dark and unfathomable, the boat was drawn tightly. It was pulled against the belly of a great rock, looming before us. The shore was daunting, the water deep. They carved footholds into the rock's edge to climb onto this embankment. When I crossed yesterday, I thought I'd face the first danger. Covered in cold sweat, I slowly clung on to climb up. But that old man then, he was completely unfazed. Kosaka smiled faintly. He just hooked his toes without effort, while I, on his back, simply closed my eyes. Then saying, "Let's walk a bit," he set me down on the shore. From then on, we slowly drifted from the stream. After crossing 3 rice field paths, We found ourselves on a single red earth road, with scattered pine trees gracing both sides. Though it was mid-June, I felt it was an unusually hot day here. But as we crossed the river, Mount Tamuro began to breathe out clouds. Dark, heavy clouds drifted back and forth over the tranquil waters of the rice paddies. The spaces between the roadside pines grew dim, and just as their tops began to murmur, large raindrops started to scatter. Before we passed even five trees, a fierce, axle-breaking downpour erupted. "Wait. Wait a moment," the old man murmured, taking my hand. "Come on, take it off. It'll be ruined," he urged. I untied my obi, stripped off my formal kimono, and even the light blue-collared undergarment, leaving nothing. The child was utterly naked, not a single thread. The rain poured like a bath, and fear made me tremble. "You're strong, so strong," the old man said. He bundled my clothes, stuffing them into his pocket. Then he untied his string and donned his hat, shading his face low. He then made me stand by a tree trunk. Soon, he unfolded his familiar oil paper rain cloak, covering me completely from the crown of my head until only my eyes peeked out, like a small parcel wrapped in persimmon tannin paper. "There, it's done. You won't get wet even if you dive into the sea," he cried. "Now run straight ahead, pull." With that, I felt a sharp slap on my bottom as if struck by a plank. My wet paper fan tore apart, leaving only its fragile bones. I flew out like some strange creature, stumbling into the downpour. Wrapped completely in the cloak, all that was visible were my legs. "A red frog transformed, transformed!" the old man cackled with laughter. But by then, I couldn't hear anything. All was dark and bewildering. I crashed into something like a black mountain, tumbling head over heels onto my back. In the waterfall-like rain, I heard the hee-hee of a horse's whinny. Slowly, I was helped up by human hands. It was a stout woman, about 50 years old, who unbound my rain cloak. A lone horseman stood nearby, arms crossed. Drops flowed from the green willows by the gate onto the black horse's back. The clouds had already broken, and beneath the thin wisps, a blue sky stirred above the willow branches. "A strange thing has descended upon us. If this were tofu, we wouldn't need capital," the horseman mused, rolling a cigarette butt in his palm. "Or perhaps we should offer it to the shrine with a ritual paper attached."
"Master, what happened?"
the old woman asked. But he only looked around, bewildered.
"Where did this beggar come from?"
she said, again a cruel remark.
Indeed, wrapped naked in persimmon tannin paper, one wouldn't expect a respectable lineage. And the old man who stripped off my clothes? With regret, I looked back the way we came. Because I was small, I could peer under the horse's belly. Beyond the pine trees after the rain, past the irrigation canal at the edge of the green fields, all the way to a distant white heron taking flight. The path stretched far and wide. The western sun cast a faint red glow, but due to the sudden downpour, the road was deserted, and there was no sign of the old man. "When I started to weep silently at my misfortune," she said, "this one's so hungry it can't even speak." "It looks like a merchandise that money could buy, but shall I offer you some? Then, from a moss-covered tub, in a cramped, dark corner of the dirty earthen floor, where benches were lined up, she took out half a block of tofu. With her wrinkled hands, she stacked it white and thrust it toward my cheek, saying, "There, there." But how could I possibly eat that? And yet, my stomach was as empty as if it had been dried out. But my chest felt full, and when I shook my head, she muttered, "Like a dog that picks its food," and plopped the tofu back into the water with a splash. "This ungrateful brat, get out," she snapped. The blackness of her wrinkled hand thrust towards my chest, and her face as if hardened with lacquer. "Black granny, don't be so heartless," the horseman interjected. So her name was Black Granny indeed. "Pay back your debt, you laborer," he yelled. Behind the tofu tub was a wisteria trellis, thick with spider webs. Using this as a boundary, in the small adjacent house, with no walls or fences, an old woman, appearing about 10 years my senior, squatted by the hearth, hands on her knees. Perhaps unable to bear it, she slid down from the veranda, stepped over the rough, scattered stones, and emerged from beneath the wisteria trellis. Her face was gentle, her complexion fair. "Children, children, come to me," she called softly. "Go quickly to White Granny's house. If you have no debt, don't tie your horse here." And the horseman said, thrusting his pipe deep into his waist pouch. So, led by the hand, naked, I passed through the corner of the earthen floor. As I was led into the neighboring house, kites cried overhead, and in the distance I heard many voices and festival drums. Kosaka pondered. From the ferry crossing onwards, this place is etched in my memory forever. Even when I came here again, as if retracing a previous life's journey, I carefully looked for every single pine and every single bridge, but there were no houses like I remembered, and I couldn't find the willow tree either. And now, with trains passing straight through, about 3 ri away, there are no longer any people walking by. I suppose that horseman and the old folks are no longer of this world. I feel as if their shadows were buried exactly there, right over that spot, my dear sister. The flower seller stopped, as if held back, still facing away. "I feel as though I am walking with you, just the two of us. And what did you do after that? Please tell me," she said, gently turning forward. Kosaka slowly continued. "Until the daughter came to care for me, I had no idea how to dress myself. It's a hot season, so it shouldn't be too bad. But you must be starving. Here, eat this," she said. It was a grilled eggplant on a skewer, pulled from the smoldering ashes of the hearth. It was puffed up, a deep reddish brown, and steam gently rose from it. Compared to humble raw tofu, it felt like an extravagant meal. And the one who offered it was a gentle old woman. She spoke of how this eggplant, born from good earth, was the first harvest in the village. I gratefully bit into 3, my empty stomach welcoming them. As the warm juice slowly seeped into my lower belly, I drifted off to sleep. But waking, a piercing pain began. Soon I was vomiting and purging. A crude story, but I was completely racked with agony. I still wonder how I even managed to survive that day. Yet by then, I was already held in the gentle hands of my life-giver.